Up in the 1950s, Brian is charting his erratic journey towards adulthood, and today, on his return from active service in Kenya, he applies for a scholarship at Cambridge while embarking on a romance in Waltham Cross. The reader is David Troughton.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
The way to look at national service, I discovered, was to see it as an interlude. Some people had spent 2 years doing mind-numbing clerk duties. I had taken part in a small war, in scenarios that no amount of Wordsworth could have prepared me for. I could do things and think things that I would never have the need to do or think again. But most important of all, I had let go some of the cumbersome baggage of childhood. While I was hardly a man, I was at any rate no longer a boy. The plane bringing me into London flew over a landscape of such staggering greenness that it caused a lump in my throat. It was like coming home to an altogether strange country, placid and somnolent, in a bath of gently diffused sunlight. Waltham Cross was difficult. During my absence, my mother had moved on to soft furnishings as her emotional solace. Where before she had bought jumble sale sweaters to unpick, now she sought out end-of-roll fabrics at what my old boss Mr. Fishpool called monster giveaway prices. It was the price that mattered more than the design or colour, leading to lime-green cushions arranged on orange loose covers. My father's restless energy had led him to paper one wall of the dining room with red and blue poppies, set off by a bamboo trellis design on the other three. Outside, the famous lawn glowed emerald. Neither of them asked a single question about Kenya. He out of spite, she because for all she knew, Kenya was just across the channel somewhere.
"You forgot your dinner jacket when you went away," she said. "I gave it a bit of a sponge last weekend, because I suppose you'll be gadding about a bit from now on."
"Not in that," I promised.
"Do they let you home at all? Someone was telling me it lasts 3 years, this college stuff."
"The terms are only 8 weeks long."
"Your kind of job, then."
Round at George and Vi's, there was an atmosphere. S, as she was entitled to do, had been seeing someone else. It was perhaps more accurate to say that she had been laid siege to by a co-worker at the bank. Roy was exactly what I would have become without the aggressive interventions of Hartford Grammar School. Moony, sentimental to a fault, starstruck. 9 years older than S, he conducted an antiquated form of courtship. He was William Guppy pursuing Esther Summerson in Bleak House. But then, who was I? Smoking a pipe with sopping wet black soldiers in the Aberdares was one thing. Smoking it in the Cross was twice as dangerous. Who was this drip in desert boots who dared poke his nose in where honest men drank? In the bar of the Gun and Magpie, they talked allotments and football. I knew little of either and was new to pub culture, ordering as my first civilian drink a pint of stout and mild, which was seen by the locals as a gross, possibly foreign, perversion. When I followed that up with a blushing request for a brandy and ginger, the jig was up.
"Then what?" a large man demanded. "How about a gin and vermouth?"
He got his laugh. A 20-year-old kid who smoked a pipe and only ordered drinks if they were mixed with other drinks was either weak in the head or taking the piss. There was another reason for their show of disdain.
"You don't half speak posh," my mother had said.
I had come out of the army with the tick of excessively polite address. In Kenya, a mannered way of talking had gone unnoticed, but in places like the Gun and Magpie, it marked me out.
"Well," Vi said loyally, "they must have some nice shops out there, because you've come back with a very smart jacket, I must say."
I explained how I had been sent by the president of the mess one afternoon to buy whiskey at an Asian store in Nyeri. On the face of it, nothing could have been simpler. But the Aziz family, father and son, saw me coming. Flattered, given mint tea for the stomach, and pressed to sample shortbread biscuits baked in the Queen's beloved Highlands, I only narrowly avoided being sold a radiogram in a walnut-finished cabinet. After 2 hours of chiding and beseechment, I walked out with a case of whiskey and the jacket. George laughed at the story, but Vi was confused. I had left a boy, and now here I was back again as some sort of half-baked sophisticate with a line in Bizarre Stories. 2 years had altered S. At the bank, she was earmarked for higher things. Her faintly emphatic way of speaking, the colossal fund of common sense she possessed, and her loyalty to the institution made her a clerk with huge added value. About Roy, she was calm itself. "It's not as if you and I are engaged or anything," she pointed out. "And you've come home a very changed person. Everyone's noticed it."
"Who's everyone?"
"Oh, you're so full of yourself, so conceited. Well, I should go off to university if I were you. I'm sure you'll fit in very well." In the movies, from which I derived much of my emotional language, I could turn and walk away down the rain-swept pavements. When she turned and walked the 100 yards or so to her house alone, it was drama enough. In my first year at Trinity, I lived out of college in circumstances not much different to life at the Cross. On my first day in student digs, Mrs. Wilson showed me upstairs to a back bedroom, going out of her way to tell the story of a young gentleman who had arrived drunk the previous evening, opened the window with too much of a flourish, and tumbled head over heels into Mr. Wilson's shed. The hole in the roof was plain to see.
"That won't happen to me," I said.
I looked around me in mild despair. A single bed bearing a faded green eiderdown lurked against one wall. There was a battered Rexine armchair, a desk, and a small wardrobe.
"The man downstairs is foreign," Mrs. Wilson said before leaving, her eyes glittering.
Shortly after my arrival, I found out that Figgy had married an RAF technician. I was told this at the Cambridge Jazz Club, and for a moment the room reeled. The girl who told me asked whether I wanted Figgy to know I was back. I said no.
"Are they happy?"
"She married him, didn't she?" 2 nights later, I cycled into Hall for dinner, jumped off my bike and, stuffing my pipe into Mr. Aziz's jacket, slotted in at the last refectory table. A servant ladled me some potato soup.
"God, it stinks in here," my neighbour grumbled.
It was uncomfortably warm, and I opened my jacket to get some air. A gout of flame leapt out. The same servant was passing with a jug of water, and he tossed the contents over my chest.
"Extraordinary," my neighbour exclaimed. "Was it a cigarette or something?"
An old love letter. Another misfortune happened a day or so later. Meeting the awesome Dr. Redpath in Trinity Street, and falling in with him the better to discuss balladry in a learned but bantering way, I flicked my pipe to clear it of dottle. The stem shot clear, leaving me with the lighted bowl in my fist. Redpath continued walking as though nothing had happened, save for one momentary twitch of his eyebrows. But then a realization burst upon him.
"Of course! You are the man who wrote to the college on naffy notepaper! I see who you are now!"
I cut round the corner, blushing and heavy with stupidity. The first time that I walked into the faculty library, I sat down at a table that happened to have on it Christopher Marlowe, Overreacher, by Harry Levin, a study of the playwright based on the gloriously simple proposition contained in the title. I read it from cover to cover like a novel, and then made my way to the pub in great spirits.
If this was the kind of critical stance required, then I would do well. I could, and did, dispense with lectures to spend the balance of my time reading, smoking, and drinking the modified antifreeze that was Yugoslav Riesling. By these stratagems, I would somehow or other acquire wisdom. Or if not that, a fitful understanding of how difficult scholarship was. 3 years of this and he'll end up in the nut house, my mother said when I came home at the end of the Michaelmas term. I mean, look at you. She was referring to my pipe, a bright yellow calabash that passed, or so I supposed, without comment in Cambridge, but looked effete beyond words in Waltham Cross. As did the foulard scarf, the crew-neck beige sweater, and the cavalry twill trousers. There was no one in the Cross even remotely dressed like me, unless it was an amateur actor walking on for the co-op players as Gerald, the self-deluded poet. My mother shook her head in despair. Couldn't you have brought yourself a comb for Christmas? But the dispute with my father went further than how I dressed. My means-tested county scholarship made him an unwilling contributor to the costs of my education. I want to be fair to him as much as possible. He was an intelligent man, driven by personal and sexual disappointments as woundy as any felt by his crazy wife. I had spent 10 years looking after a bipolar mum while he was away in the RAF. Keeping mum was the phrase, and much more to the point, keeping mum about what had gone on in his absence. My mother made a cuckold of him with a number of Americans. This was the stumbling block between us. Even as a child, I had somehow colluded in my mother's betrayal of him. Seen in this stark light, my place at Cambridge was an unjustified reward. For 9 vacations, I worked at jobs he found me, and each week surrendered to him my unopened wage packet. He gave me back spending money. The crowded envelope of banknotes was not for my share of the cost of sausage and chips or shepherd's pie. Taking money he did not need enshrined his honestly held opinion of university education as a shameless contribution to the history of malingering. He had not needed higher education. Why should he spend a penny of his own on mine? "Well, he has got a point," my mother mumbled. "I'll give him this. He don't owe nobody nothing for what he's made of himself." I was amazed to hear her say it, for in my eyes he'd made himself a monster. To this day, whether he loved me or not, I cannot say. But it was clear that he did not like me far beyond what was normal in a parent of ordinary sensibilities. He did not like me the way he could not stand dogs or garden slugs. All of which left me with the question, what was I going to do about it? In an image that comes easily from those times, I stopped staring at the wire and began digging the tunnel.
There may be teardrops to shed, so while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
What happens after Cambridge? We'll find out in the final part at this time tomorrow. Clever Girl, A Sentimental Education by Brian Thompson and abridged by Doreen Estill was read by David Troughton. The producer was Amber Barnfather.
I'll never forget it. She said, "Mummy, God's made a mistake. I'm not a little boy. I'm a girl."
Based on real life experiences, a drama about a boy who wants to be a girl.
Don't call me Ben. Call me Amy. I'm just a girl. Nightmare.
Just a Girl on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
School starts in September. I don't know anybody. How am I supposed to make friends when I don't know who or what I am?
You do know who you are.
A freak? A weirdo? Neither one thing or another.
Don't say that.
On Saturday at midday, and then on the Radio 4 Extra website.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock and welcome. It's Alan with you here on 4 Extra, where we're about to indulge ourselves in an hour of great drama in a minute with The Summer of a Dormouse. That's next. And later on this evening, we've an hour of comedy of the classic variety, starting with the Dad's Army Pier Restoration spin-off, It Sticks Out Half a Mile, at 7, and Les Dawson's sketch show Listen to Les at 7:30. So, it's time for drama now, in The Summer of a Dormouse by John Mortimer. It's the story of Henry Troutbeck Pottinger, who, as a boy and a young man, is continually visited by his elder self.
The Summer of a Dormouse, a play written for radio by John Mortimer, with Paul Schofield, Alex Jennings and Joe Roberts as Henry Troutbeck Pottinger. The Summer of a Dormouse.
Come on, my braves, heroes of the French Foreign Legion. To the battlements, you rogues and vagabonds. Prop up the dead bodies of your fallen comrades.
What's the point of that, then?
To deceive the crafty Tuaregs.
I ought to warn you.
Warn me of what?
You're young now. Young enough to be defending Fort Zindernoef with Burgess. You're only 11.
I'm 12.
Not yet, are you?
Well, I'm 12 next birthday. I always tell people I'm 12.
Of course you do. We've always specialised in small, unimportant lies. Why did you join the French Foreign Legion, by the way?
A stolen diamond.
Of course.
Usually it's unhappy love affairs.
At the age of 11, what can you know about unhappy love affairs?
What do you know about them?
I've had them. Naturally, I've had them. And happy ones, too, which are considerably more painful.
Who are you, anyway?
Someone who came to warn you.
Warn me of what?
The time of your life will come. It will come. When you'll hear a voice from the sky, thundering. Perhaps the voice...